Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to the world's smartest podcast network.
When I go to Sacramento, I will pump up Sacramento. Sacramento.
Some say the news is fake. Others say it's real. These two don't have the time to check. Instead, Turner Sparks and Michael Ira Kaplan turn to comics stationed around the globe to be their eyewitness reporters so that you can know what's really going on. This is Lost in America.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Lost in America. I'm Mike Kaplan.
And I'm Turner Sparks.
You can find me at Cap'n America on all social media platforms. And you can find Turner at... What's it, Turner Sparks?
Oh, you're blowing this already. It's 305 episodes in. I says, Cap, let's give Kaplan a shot at introing the show. And immediately doesn't know my social media, at Turner Sparks on Instagram.
You know what it is? I know it's at Turner Sparks, but I was thinking, I was like trying to remember if there was an X or not. I was going to say, because I knew you had the email address.
No,
I got all confused.
No,
I'm sorry.
It's just
I blew it.
Email. Now you're giving away my email
next
address.
Next time, in the 500th episode, I'll do the intro again. And I'll get it right.
Well, I figured, Cap, we got to get you to do the intro because you need as much airtime right now as possible because you're not in the rest of this show.
I'm not going to be in this episode. This is a very special episode. Yeah. So just this for my fans out there, you might want to turn it off. I'm dying.
This is World's Smartest Podcast Network Roundtable we're doing today, everybody, with the great Andrew Heaton, Professor Andrew Heaton from the Political Orphanage.
Now
podcast.
You're blowing it. Yeah.
Flagship show on the World's Smartest Podcast Network. And Dr. Andrea Jones Roy from the Majoring in Everything podcast. You know her. And me, and no Kaplan, Kaplan had to sell a house. He's got to make a living at some point.
I was trying to pay the bills. I don't usually, you know, drop anything for a podcast, but they said it's a cash offer. I said,
cash
I'm just gonna
offer.
Show up. They're gonna bring a bag of money. That's gonna show up at the door and hand it to me. And I said, all right, place will be sold.
You know,
so
I was telling Kaplan this off air, but when I was a child, we moved. Gary Sparks moved us out of a house just abruptly out of nowhere. The home we grew up in, our childhood home, very, very. It hits your heart as an 8-year old because he comes home one day. He goes, "Everybody, guess what? We sold the house."
And I said, "It wasn't even for sale.
It was on sale." He goes, "They had a cash offer." And so out of nowhere, we had to move into this like rental house kind of. It was covered in mold. We all got pneumonia. And
we had to live there for 18 months as a result.
We had to live there for 18 months until these contractors like rushed to build us a new house out in the woods because Gary had a cash offer. So I know cash offers are important. I've always known.
Yeah, if you're up in the Sacramento area and you want to get a hold of this house that they built, just show up with a bag of cash and Gary Sparks. Yeah, your parents' house is for sale tomorrow.
If you show up with a duffel bag full of cash, he'll go, "Murder, we're moving. They had a cash offer."
Living out of the car for the next year.
Florida, Arizona, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, they're going to show up at your house in Brooklyn and be like, we got a cash offer. We had to leave.
We got a cash offer. So anyway, you are working on, I asked if you sold. You said they're still working on it, but it was a cash offer. They showed up at a Starbucks with a duffel bag in the Upper West Side.
Upper East Side. They showed up at the apartment with a bag of, with a briefcase. They just opened it up and it glowed. It was like Pulp Fiction.
Fiction, just full of gold bars. Yeah, so, and they said, "Does this mean anything to you?"
Yeah, and I was sitting there eating a burger. It was very strange. No, anyway.
So today, we'll get into it in a minute. But so Cap couldn't join us, but Heaton and Andrea and I talk about, you remember the comedian Hannah Gadsby?
Yes,
and I don't want to go too far into it, but we talk about her. You'll hear more about it later, but everybody follow all of us. This is the World's Smartest Podcast Network Roundtable. Of course, Andrew Heaton, the Political Orphanage, you can check out. All these are on your phone, just whatever podcast player you use. And Andrea Jones Roy, the Majoring in Everything podcast. We are Lost in America. Kaplan, I think let's get, unless there's anything
Patreon?
I'm missing here, let's get
Patreon.
Patreon. Excuse me. And of course, yeah. Cap and I are doing our Full Throttle Comedy podcast, Lost in the Bunker, a couple times a week over there, patreon.com/lostinamerica. There's a link in the description of this show. Click that link and you can sign up. That'll get you for $5 a month. You get that show. Plus you get these off the record shows.
Off the record episodes. Yeah. Once a month we have a comedian on and we just discuss a guest, someone who's been on Lost in America. And we discuss stuff they couldn't say on the air when they were with us.
Yeah. And if you would have signed up and these are non-recorded shows.
The last
shows.
Episode we did was, no joke, probably better than any Lost in America we've done in a long time. It was fantastic. So you guys all
missed
out.
We had Anton Timoshenko in Kyiv, Ukraine. And the thing is, they're all going to be better than any Lost in America we could do because of the fact that they're not being recorded. So these comedians are free to say anything they want to say. And not only that, you as the listener, you as the Patreon subscriber, you're in the Zoom. It's a Zoom chat. You get to ask them questions. You get to ask them whatever you want to hear. Aaron Welch was in there last time asking questions.
He had some
questions.
Great questions. Hard-hitting questions.
Yeah, a lot of questions that he said, well, you might not be saying this on the air, but what do you think about X? And then Anton could take time. There's no pressure to get the word out right away because dead air or anything. He could think about it. I've never thought about that before, but here's my opinion.
He said, you're right. Putin is a great leader. No, he didn't say that.
But he did not say that.
I'm not going to say.
So all that, patreon.com/lostinamerica. And it helps
you can show
us
up at my house
doing this show.
You could also show up my house with a bag of money, and I will sign you up for you if you just give me that. But yeah, patreon.com/lostinamerica.
Or my house with a bag of money. Why does it have to be your house with money? I'll take people's money.
All right. I was going to share it anyway. And since you're not going to hear me on this episode, can I say get lost?
Anyway. No, don't get lost. We're just starting the show. Let's get to the show.
Get to the episode.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the show. I am here. I'm Turner Sparks from the Lost in America podcast. I am here with Andrew Heaton from the Political Orphanage. How you doing, Andrew?
I'm great, Turner. If I were any better, I'd be Turner or maybe even Andrea Jones-Roy.
Oh, you know, on our show, we call you Professor Andrew Heaton.
Nice.
Only because we whenever we introduce the shows on the World's Smartest Podcast Network, all of our shows, we always say Dr. Andrea Jones-Roy from the Majoring in Everything podcast. And then it feels a slight to not give you a title. Mm. And you do feel like a professor.
I feel like one. I will defer to Andrea, the actual professor of this. However, I know of a title you could quasi give me that there's at least more merit to. When I was over in the Baltics last summer, I went to a self-proclaimed independent republic called Uzupis.
Sure.
Uzupis is a Uzupis is its own little. It's basically like imagine a neighborhood inside of the capital going, fuck it, we're our own country, and kind of ran with it. And I met with the foreign minister just to chat with him about it. And he was real squirrely when I told him I was a journalist. And then after about 20 minutes, like we were talking about stuff, I was like, honestly, man, I'm a comedian. I didn't think you'd meet with me if I told you I'm a comedian. I'm not really a journalist. And he was like, oh, great. Then he really warmed up to me at the end. He went, we already have an ambassador to America. Do you want to be the comedy ambassador? And I was like, is that what I'd be? He was like, yeah, you'd be our ambassador. I think it's like ambassador of comedy to Texas or something like that. It's like very specific.
Wow.
But I am an ambassador according to somebody who's not me.
Fantastic. Okay. You know what it reminds me of? Do you know when you go to Key West, they claim they're an independent country.
And they've done that before.
Seceded at one point for like 6 months in the 1700s.
Yeah.
The Conch Republic is what they call themselves.
And why did they come back?
I think it ran out of steam real quick.
Yeah. Well, no, they do this every 20 years. The governor of Key West or mayor, whatever he is, like runs out of transportation money and then threatens to secede from America unless we give him more money. Like this is a tradition in Key West to secession regularly.
And the third voice you're hearing is Dr. Andrea Jones-Roy of the Majoring in Everything podcast.
What's up?
Dr. Andrea, how are you doing?
I am good. I'm very good. Heaton, statistically, you're the most professorial person I know. So I think that's...
Thank you.
Yeah, a statistical professor, as we could call you.
Can I ask a question? Yep. And apologies if this should have been an off-air question. But are you still at NYU?
I'm not. You wouldn't know it from the fact that I'm wearing an NYU t-shirt right now. But
are we breaking news with that question?
Somewhat.
Does the general public?
Wait, hold on. I am so hoping that you've gone full-time circus. That is what I'm hoping. I'm hoping you are now full-time circus, Cirque du Soleil, something like that. What's up?
Yeah, I wish. Starring on Broadway in a waterfall covered in sequins. No, but I am leaving NYU. It's not a secret, but it's like a slow dismount. Like I negotiated with them for a while and decided to go my own way, but I'm still employed by them through the end of the summer. So I'm not teaching anymore, and I'm going to be in need of some health insurance pretty soon, but I'm on my way out and trying to figure out what's next, including very likely a political science podcast coming back. Stay tuned for that. I'm done talking to Gen Z. I got to talk to people my own age.
Wait, so Andrea, are you now a rogue professor, or you will be a rogue professor?
Yes, indeed.
I like this.
So you need to become, isn't that what like Jordan Peterson and all those people
I think
are?
So, yeah.
They're professors in name, like they used to be. Like you call someone coach for their whole life. Even
right.
They haven't coached
or like
football
chef
since
or something.
The 70s.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Colonel, now you're a professor.
Yeah, yeah, rogue professor. That's the idea. So if
anyone knows... Well, and then history tells us this is when you make the big bucks.
Well, that's the idea.
Rogue.
Yeah, I'm done with that NYU money. We're going for Spotify money, or sponsored post
Andrea,
money.
You know what you need to do is get fired, right? If you're already leaving... And
yeah.
you're about to go back into media. You realize that if you could say something that's a little bit ambiguous that gets you in super trouble with a mm-hmm. bunch of pointy-headed Gen Zers, it can mm-hmm. only help your career at this point, right?
You know what I should do? What an easy one would be to use the Chinese word for that one in a public context. I'm not even saying it now.
I dare not say it out loud,
so
but I...
You know I'm going with this, Turner?
If it's the one I'm thinking of, it sounds suspiciously like the word that ends your career in America. Is that right?
That's
like
the one.
Like a racial slur. Yeah.
And I think a business professor in California got fired for it. So that's an easy one, and I could justify it because I say, oh, well, I study Chinese, and da-da-da. Mm-hmm. And then I just drop it.
Oh, you're right. Someone did get fired for that. And then that launches you into a world of free speech.
Exactly.
And we should be allowed to say what we want.
Exactly.
Speaking of that, should we get to today's
Let's
topic?
Let's do it, yeah.
So... Hannah Gadsby recently, you remember her. She, that's the way I like to introduce her. She hasn't been relevant since 2017, in my opinion. So she made a big comedy special in 2017. She's an Australian talker, comedian, kind of talker person with a lot of opinions. And she made this comedy special on Netflix that was, for a lot of people, the first time we'd ever heard of her. I'm a stand-up. We all do stand-up comedy. I'd never heard of her before until this comedy special, where she announced in the special that she was retiring from comedy because it seemingly was like beneath her, as far as I could tell.
Mm.
And she was above it. And as an art form, it wouldn't let her express what she wanted. Meanwhile, I don't think 95% of us knew she was a comedian to start with. So it's confusing when somebody says they're retiring because they're better than you, but you've never heard of them.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's what she started with. And so we'll have time to, you know, if you want me, if I'm wrong, you can.
No, we could totally gossip. I love gossiping about other people in entertainment. I love gossiping and turn them down a peg. We can absolutely do that.
These are facts. Okay. I mean, I never heard of her. And she did say, I think that was the platform, that comedy is beneath her, and she got sexually assaulted and wanted to be talk about that in a joke format, but I don't know maybe she didn't want people to laugh or something. I'm not sure. Anyway, point is, that all happened in 2017, and then we haven't heard much. She did very well off that. That was because it was called The Net. It went huge. Didn't hear much. Maybe she did a tour or two, probably sold everything out for a couple of years. And then the pandemic happened, and then a lot in our lives happened, and then we kind of haven't heard from her in the last few years, as far as I can tell. I personally have not heard from her. Most comedians I know have not heard from her. I did hear recently that apparently she put a couple specials out between now and then that I don't think they did as well as the first one. They might have done well with her niche audience. And then now she's back with she curated an exhibit, an art exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum. Where it's called, the idea of it is to cancel Pablo Picasso. You remember him. He's a artist who died, I believe, 50 years ago or more. And she thought he was problematic, and he didn't, I don't know exactly why. He didn't like women, probably. And he didn't like her, I guess. And or people like her. And so she put on this art exhibit to cancel Pablo Picasso, basically being like, he sucks and the world needs to know he sucks. And it's the 50th anniversary of his death is when they decided to do it. And I think it's fair to say the idea behind it was to get attention. That would be, I don't think that's wrong. I think a lot. I don't even think that's bad. I think people do stuff for attention. If you haven't been in the news since 2017, it's probably you probably want to be back in the news. So this would be a way to do that. And it was seemingly met. Why I wanted to talk about this on this topic on the show is because rather than it was seemingly met with at best disdain for the idea of canceling Pablo Picasso, at worst a shrug to a lot of people didn't even know this happened. So either you didn't know it happened, or if you did know it happened, mainstream general media like the New York Times and a bunch of art specific blogs and papers and respected, I don't know, journalists in art, all kind of thought this is sort of stupid. Picasso died 50 years ago. And beneath that, they kind of went into all the reasons why the artist, a couple of the artists she did feature. So she featured a couple of pieces of art from Picasso and then a lot from women who the idea being, I think instead of focusing on how great Picasso was, what about these women? And, you know, one of the women was cited that her favorite artist is Pablo Picasso. So a lot of it didn't really add up. But I think the general synopsis was from all across media that we're sort of done with cancel culture as a performative thing. Hmm. The idea of we want to cancel people, but really we want the attention on us. Mm. And this seems to be the height of it. As someone who died 50 years ago, we're not taking their career away. There doesn't seem to be much into it besides look at me, I'm Hannah Gadsby. And so I thought that was an interesting point in the world where we're at. I think if she did, and then I'll let everyone else say their piece, but the last thing I want to say is I think if she put this out in 2017, she would have been lauded as a hero. This is great. The timing's perfect. We just took down Harvey Weinstein. We just took down Bill Cosby. Those are all
time to take out
people.
The true monster, the dead Pablo Picasso.
It had momentum. The whole idea, but also because there were genuine people who were doing bad things at that time who needed to be stopped from doing bad things. And this seems a little bit like 6 years too late. It's sort of like if Poison released an album in 1998. And everyone goes, okay, hair metal kind of ended a decade ago. I feel like that arm of comedy and art, where it's just art for the sake of getting rid of other people, I feel like might be over. But I want to bring you all in. I want to bring Andrea in first because you might have a different interpretation of all this than me. So
awesome.
Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Turner. I will say that I think for the first time that we've done these roundtables have been nervous about this one because I was like, we talk about how it's a roundtable, but I was like, I'm going to really disagree with everyone on this roundtable for today. Great. So I was like stressed out about it. There's obviously a lot that you've said that I do agree with. So I'm a huge Hannah Gadsby fan, and I had also not heard of her until 2017. And I went with to see Nanette live in 2017. And I went with three friends, one of whom was Australian, which was the only reason anyone had ever heard of her. And she, none of them were comics. And she said, oh, there's this comedian I really like from back home. Like, does anyone want to go? I said, yeah, fine. We had seats like in the first or second row. I had no idea what I was getting into. And the first 20 minutes, I was like, this is okay. It's not great, but like, whatever. It's the Soho Playhouse, small venue, nothing special. And then when it turned to the more serious stuff, I was stunned and I was very impressed and very moved by it. So much so that by the end of it, I was like, I have to see that again and I have to change how I do comedy. And I forced my boyfriend to come with me a second time and some comedian friends of ours, mutual friends, and we all went because I was like, my boyfriend will never understand me if he doesn't see this thing. So it really spoke to me. And I really loved what she did. I'll be the first to agree it's not the most hilarious special in the world. There's a million other comedy specials that I would watch instead of this one if I wanted to sit down and laugh. And it's certainly not quotable in the way that a lot of great comics are, and you retell, you know, their jokes a million times, and it's not that. And whether we want to call it stand-up or not is sort of beside the point to me, and we can have that conversation. But I found it to be really moving in terms of using comedy to say something that felt really important at the time. So I've seen that one twice. I've seen it on Netflix. It's not as good on Netflix as it was in person. Fine. She has released two other specials since then, and I have seen both of them in person. I had front row seats for her second show, And I had not front row, but decent seats for her third show. So she did one here in Union Square and one over at Brooklyn Academy of Music. They were not as good, for sure. The second one was called Douglas. It was about being diagnosed with autism. She mostly was very good. I'm not going to like recap them all, but she did a very good like self-referential, like, hey, many of you are probably here because of Nanette. Like, why? I said all the things. Like, I have nothing else to say. It's like funny that you've showed up. But she did an okay job. The third one, I think she tried to do something like more lighthearted. It was like a feel-good show. It wasn't as good. So they definitely got worse. And I can see the move to like, I want attention. She kind of hit a note back in 2017 on, you know, Pablo Picasso being problematic, air quotes, and some other things. But so I don't love what she's doing now, but I have her book. Like, I really think that she used comedy in a way that's very bold. And to this day, I find inspiring and important. And the only other thing I'll say that I do very much disagree with you on, Turner, is my read on what she said on stage. I could be mistaken or misremembering. Well, she didn't say she was quitting comedy. She said she felt like she needed to quit comedy because all the comedy she was doing was self-deprecating and that self-deprecation was like bad for her psychologically. And so she said, like, I need to walk away from this because it changed. And that also hit me because all my comedy is self-deprecating. And I've wondered about what that says about myself and what I'm doing, but that's a separate matter. So I think she's bold, brave, amazing. That said, I'm not going to go see this exhibit. I haven't seen it. And I think I, interestingly, Turner, when you shared this article with us as a possible roundtable topic, I hadn't even heard of it. It did not come across my radar. No one I know is talking about it. And I think that's maybe the sign, like what you said, you're like, people are either have heard about it and are like, oh God, we're sick of this, or it's not even on their radar. And it's not even on my radar. And I follow her on all the things and I'm actually like surprised. But also the one last thing I'll say is I'll be the first to agree with you on criticizing her comedy in this domain, which is she likes puns a lot more than anyone who's a professional comedian should.
God.
And the Pablomatic is like bad. And even in her second special, Douglas, which I thought was very good, she had a whole section on puns and I was just like, oh Christ. Like that weakened the whole thing. But I think Nanette was a revolution and I think it sucks that we have gotten away from the fact that she just did something very interesting with comedy. And I, you know, Mike Birbiglia does that kind of stuff. Like, I think there's like an interesting genre, and maybe we'll talk about this later with comedy and storytelling. And like, sure, we can move away from calling it stand-up. But I think that what she did there was amazing. But I agree, this feels more grovelly and less important given everything else that we're going through as a world right now.
I have one question for you, and then I'll bring Heaton in. Do you think if this, I have a lot to say, but I'll one question. Do you think if this would have come out at a different time, it would have been received differently?
The Pablo exhibit?
Yes.
I agree. Yes. I think you're right about that. I think if it had come out, say, in 2018 or something, especially on the heels of Nanette and everything, you're like, pow, like here's a way of, I'm not even sure what the point is other than maybe spotlight new artists, then yes. But I feel like since then, like even Me Too feels old, which sucks because it's not like women aren't getting harassed and there isn't sexual misconduct all over the place for all people.
Sure.
But it doesn't feel like the pressing issue of our time and it does feel more like an attention grab. So totally. I think, you know.
And I'll say maybe if there still are alive people to Me Too.
Yeah.
That need to be Me Too'd. Even more reason why this shouldn't. We there's other places to put our attention. And the last thing I want to say before I bring in Heaton, as you said, the pun thing. So a lot of what the exhibit is, it's also been criticized just for being lazy. So there's pictures of Picasso's paintings. And then under it, she leaves what the New York Times describes as Instagram comments.
Ooh.
But she's the only one leaving the comment underneath. And while Heaton's talking, I'll go find some of them. But they're little quips about how stupid the painting is.
I see.
Picasso painting.
Okay.
This one's dumb because of this. This one's dumb because of this.
All right.
Heaton, where do you land on all this? Specifically, because we'll talk about other things, on the lens of timing and with as cancel culture has hit the point where the mainstream is ready to move on, roll their eyes, or not? What do you think?
I agree with your basic thesis, Turner. In fact, I weirdly disagree with you on a small level because I agree with you on a bigger level. And what I mean by that is the article that I read from the New York Times that you sent out, Gadsby had at the beginning of the exhibit, there's a quote when you come in that says, you can appreciate and be angry at the same time. That to me is not cancel culture. Cancel culture is very much built around this idea of heresy and blasphemy, that there are certain things that cannot be uttered under any context or situation, and that you must be brought to heel and justice if you dare offend the cosmos. Saying you can appreciate somebody and be angry at them at the same time is correct. That mm-hmm. is how we should be interpreting such people. Pablo Picasso was a monster. Everything I've read about him is that he was an absolute shitbag to women at a colossal level. There's a painting he has of a woman where she's got a mole, and it's not a mole. It's a cigarette burn he had put in her face. He was a bad guy, but he was a great painter. And being able to look at him and go, God, that guy was a sack of shit and a really good painter. I guess we live in a complicated world where people are nuanced, and they might be brilliant in one way and sadistic in another way. That's the world we live in. And that was, to me, like, that's the kickoff that she has. So I don't think she was trying to cancel him. I think she was actually saying, again, I didn't go there, but from what I'm reading, I think she was saying the same thing we were. So I don't see that so much as cancellation as heckling. It sounds to me like she was doing an exhibit where she heckled Pablo Picasso, which I agree with you, sounds very lazy to me. It sounds like a great gig. Anybody listening, if you want to hire me to heckle artists and just write witty banter underneath the painting, I can bang that out in an afternoon.
I mean, I wouldn't call it witty.
What did you say?
I said I wouldn't call it witty. Do you want me to read one of the things she wrote
Please
underneath?
Do. Please do.
So it's like some meta painting from what I can tell. And her comment underneath, in quotes, is meta, M-T-E-A, and then a question mark, like, meta? I hardly know her.
Ooh. That is hilarious in 1962. That's a
I'm
really
not even
funny...
sure it was hilarious in 62. It might have been 52 for that one.
You know what? Another good topic we should have at some point is jokes that should be retired, because I keep a list in my head of, like, all right, one ran its course. That needs to be knocked out. So, Turner, I don't think that she was actually trying to cancel Pablo Picasso. Like, canceling Pablo Picasso to me would be going to MoMA or wherever his artwork is and saying, this man is a monster. You have to put this in storage or burn it. But it can't be out for people. That's not what they were doing. And I think the parallel to this, if we were to borrow other historical figures, is rather than dynamiting a statue of Jefferson Davis or something, putting up a placard saying Jefferson Davis owned slaves and was fighting on behalf of a secessionist slavery cause, and like contextualizing it. Again, I'm fine with that. If you're not destroying the actual thing, you're allowing people to participate in it, you're seeing it, the history itself is not being expunged, but you want to have some way to contextualize it to moral and progressive society, good. I think that is the way to handle it. But to your broader point, Turner, yes, I think you're right that we have jumped the shark on cancel culture. Mm-hmm. I think we jumped the shark on cancel culture a couple of years ago. And the fact that Hannah Gatsby's great insight is this man was a monster and he was brilliant belies the fact that she was not engaging in cancel culture, and that the New York Times was so blasé and unimpressed with it further facilitates that train has stopped. And I think it was going to stop. I think the cancel culture thing was going to burn itself out, is going to burn itself out. When you're throwing a party, no one ever goes, when do the pearl clutchers get here? Hey, when do those people that freak out on stuff we say that you feel like you're walking around eggshells on? You know those people, when are they going to get to the fun party? None of us are doing that.
I know a lot of those people, if you want me to invite them. When do you guys think it ended then?
I think it's still... The Roman Empire has lost Gaul, right? Mm. Like it's still existent, but it's in the decline. And I think it was going to happen too. I think that the parallel that keeps coming back to me on woke culture, cancel culture, and so on and so forth is I think that there is a religious left, much in the same way that there was or is a religious right. I see the exact things happening. It's an illiberal, authoritarian response to information, that information is infective and must be lanced rather than combated through debate and heresy and blasphemy and so on and so forth. And with religions, if you want to have a religion that works for a really long time, you have to have some variation of the golden rule for in-group members. Speaking in non-valenced, amoral terms, you can totally throw other religions under the bus and have your religion go on very happily for a very long time. But if your internal members throw each other under the bus regularly, it undermines the whole project. And I see that with cancel culture. Yeah. And the whole – Turner, you've talked about this in the past, that like kind of once one demographic gets run under the bus, we move on to another demographic. And it's a whole system based on lop off the top of the totem pole. Well, eventually you run out of totem pole to lop off, and then what do you do?
Yeah, it's one guy jumping around in a circle saying everyone's a horrible and not him. And we see those people religiously. They're on street corners outside of – you know, the Super Bowl, yelling at people as they walk into the game that Jesus is going to, they're all going to hell except him, and they're holding a sign. And those people exist in religion too. I genuinely, whether there was a sign outside of the actual thing in the Brooklyn Museum or not, the name of this whole exhibit is Pablomatic, like problematic. Right. Again, another great pun by Hannah Gadsby. And,
it is painful.
The brilliant comedian. And so...
By the way, there's nothing more damning to a comedian than putting comedian in quotation marks. That's the meanest thing you can do to a comedian is say, Andrew Heaton, quote unquote comedian, did blah, 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 blah. It's literally the meanest thing you can do to a comedian.
And if we're talking about things that need to be retired, I'll quote another one of her things she put under a Pablo Picasso painting at the museum. She says, let's make art great again.
Wow.
Which that joke needs to be the make anything great again, right. But not like America, the jokey thing. Let's get rid of that. But no, I think this is it. I think this is the end. This is the death of cancel culture. I think this is the day it jumped the shark, because specifically, I don't think the New York Times would have written this article at any previous moment. I don't think the New York Times would have rolled their eyes at her and went, come on, get over it. Like, we get it. Enough of us know art that, enough of us know that Picasso is a bad person. You're not brave. You're not breaking any news. You're not breaking any barriers. You're telling us something we already know, and then you want to be patted on the back for it. And I think up until now, she would have been patted on the back, or they would have been patted on the back for this. This would have been a thing to be congratulated for. And while I think on the right wing of America, cancel culture ended for them a long, long time ago, I think it's taken this long to get to someone who most people would consider to the left, which is the New York Times. At worst, you would consider it the middle, right? And so I think these type of things don't truly end until like 90% of people are like, okay, got it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're at that point now.
You bring up a great point, Turner, on just kind of the institutional side of this, where there was a 10-year period where institutions were scared witless of social media. And it made no sense. Like Twinkies are racist, right? And like 50 people on Twitter say Twinkies are racist. If you went to the Twinkie Corporation and you went, did you know a stadium in Lockjaw, Oklahoma, says that you're racist, they would go, fuck them. We don't care what Lockjaw, Oklahoma. 50 people in Lockjaw, Oklahoma think that we're racist. They can go to hell. We don't care. But for some reason, if 50 people on the internet did it, everyone assumed that it was emblematic of the whole country. And they've kind of slowly realized, oh, this is just – they're all going to move on in a day or two. They're all just looking for something to be angry about. The New York Times is the best example of this, because the New York Times was utterly cowardly for 5-10 years. I don't know. I don't know what the time frame is, but there was a period of time where they would throw their own people under the bus for wrong reasons. Not the person did something that was an infraction that they should have been fired for. It's that their 24-year-old incoming college jihadists would get mad at them and they would just buckle. And in the last year or two, the New York Times has started going, you guys need to shut up or you can go work someplace else. They literally sent out a memo about this about 6 months ago where they went, the New York Times is a prestigious place. If you don't want to work here, you don't have to work here. And they finally grew a backbone. And I think institutions are realizing that letting the religious zealots come in and dictate terms to everybody was a bad way to run an institution, and they actually didn't have to listen to him.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Andrea, go ahead.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I don't even know where to start with this. So the New York Times is, I'm so glad we do these because I am reminded of how, for many reasons, but I'm reminded of how far to the left my social media ecosystem is. And maybe I've said this on this podcast before, but I love that we're talking about the New York Times because many people that I know have unsubscribed from the New York Times because it's too far to the right.
What?
And, they, no way.
And they're like, no I can't. Way. And then they will repost and tweet and all these things and say, I'm so glad I separated from the New York Times, or I unsubscribed, or I stopped giving them my money because they're supporting right wing this, that, and the other thing. And so it's really, I think, frankly, to flatter all of us, important that we are coming together, because when you're on the internet, when I'm on the internet, it's too easy to forget that this isn't what is happening for everybody.
Andrea, please, next time that I am in New York / invite myself to stay with you and your boyfriend at your guest room within easy walking distance from Reese Crisis, I want you to throw a cocktail party and invite the gang, me, Turner, and Mike, but also your super, super, super to the left friends. Because okay. I think that you would be doing a mitzvah for society to introduce them to us and us to them. Like, because there's going to be a lot of minds blown.
Well, and the amazing thing is that you two are not far to the right. If anything, you know, I've talked with, like your friend, like Jennings, about doing a podcast where we actually include someone who's like properly from the right, right? Mm-hmm. Not to assume either of your politics, but it's like the fact that you two would be so extreme. I mean, I have thought at length about the podcast that we released a handful of months ago about whether wokeness is a religion. And I was like, I might need to take that down, because if people find this, I'm going to be in really big trouble. Even though I think that we were right. The only other thing, to just add to the content that we are talking about, as opposed to my own leftward spiral, is when I hear about cancel culture these days, and maybe this is the ecosystem that I'm in, the information ecosystem that I'm in, is I hear all about the right erasing things, like Ron DeSantis removing everything that was ever written in a history textbook about race or gender, or banning this or banning that. And so if anything, the word cancel culture in the circles on the left that I am in refers to the right at this point. And so it feels very funny to talk about, oh, the right's been over cancel culture. I think they just don't call it cancel culture. I don't know what they call it, but they call it something else. But that might just be the way that I'm hearing about it. And maybe that's not quite what's happening.
Well, I
that
think
could be true. I always have thought of cancel culture as people. You're canceling this person, that person. The right doesn't do that, but
that's
they do
true.
Try to cancel books and ideas.
Yeah.
Which is not, that's well, not very good.
I
can I ask a question?
But you're right. Yeah. It's not a person. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Everybody, because this is a little off topic, but I think it's an interesting just thing to do right now.
Okay.
Can everyone name, because we all get different versions of Twitter, and Kaplan and I, who can't be here, we were talking about this the other day.
Okay.
That just name the top three topics in your Twitter feed. Because Kaplan was like, oh, Twitter's so right now. It's so right wing because Elon Musk runs it.
Yeah.
And I was like, here's what I get on Twitter. Literally what my Twitter feed is. NBA. It's what's going on in the NBA. I get what's going on in the war in Ukraine from like anti-Russia people, which is who I follow and who I support. I support Ukraine. Okay.
I'm out of here.
Which
yeah,
seems
all right.
like you're not allowed to say. I don't even know if you're allowed to say that anymore. Yeah. You're somehow.
Andrea and I don't, but for completely different reasons.
I support them to the very end. And
Putin's my
uncle. And then,
but okay.
And then comedy stuff. Those are the three things I get. If I'm going to go top three. Can you guys just think of, just because just to illustrate how different everyone's world is dependent upon. Yeah.
Here's mine. Know. Is
Yeah, go for it.
I haven't logged into Twitter in weeks. That is how far to the left I am, is that the last handful of times I did check it, it felt more right wing. It was mostly just a handful of people that are very far to the left retweeting right wing people. Like, it was all very political stuff. And it wasn't really, I even was toggling between, because he changed the like the for you versus your actual feed. And I was like kind of messing with that. And then honestly, I moved and reset like my passwords and whatever to try to refix. And I got logged out of Twitter, and now I can't autofill my password, and I just haven't logged in, and my life has been the same. And most people that I am talking to have also left Twitter. And so it's not even that I'm missing out on much. I think the academics are still there.
The left leave is not,
but the left is gone. I'm not there.
Too far right.
Yeah.
But yet it's only far right if that's who you follow, is my claim. But
totally. Yeah.
I don't know that there's even a good synthesis on mine. My Twitter tends to be like, I purposefully don't talk politics on Twitter a lot. I don't want to invite fights with strangers into my life. I find it very emotionally draining and exhausting. And so I'm probably on Twitter once every couple of weeks, and I do it somewhat begrudgingly. I don't want to live on it just for just social media in general. I'm not on too much. I'm much more likely to be on Slack or doing a podcast with people. And then the people I follow, like I have a whole list of just comedians who are still funny. That's the whole list. It's just comedians that aren't doing politics that I'm listening to. Because I don't, to be blunt, like I don't need to hear the political opinion of every comedian I know, particularly if it's not interesting. Don't like Trump. Fantastic. Great. You don't. Okay. I figured you didn't like Trump. You're a comedian who lives in New York City. I get it. And there's a bunch of them that have become one man, 24-hour news pundits that are just talking about how much they hate Trump. And I'm like, I probably even agree with you, but can you please go back to doing jokes? So I have a list of comedians who are still funny that I listen to. And then after that, it's kind of a grab bag of like libertarians, moderates, and weirdos that I follow. So like I might be like looking at something Andrew Yang does, and then like maybe the great Mitch Daniels will say something, and then like Michael Malice or Dave Smith, who I both follow, will have like a conversation about secession in America or something like that. So I don't know that there's any defining thing, but I'm also aware that it's all algorithmic, and I'm just not on it that much.
Yeah.
To backtrack a little bit though, I do want to point out. Sorry, go ahead, Turner.
No, I was going to say, we can keep going if there's another part of the topic anyone wants to bring up. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to point out, I thought it was an interesting point you bring up, Turner, that the right cancels ideas, the left cancels people. And I wanted to suss that out a little bit more. Something that I just wish to inject so that I can put in my preferred mental framework there is, I don't think that it's the right or the left that's doing the canceling. I think that we're looking at multiple spectrums of things going on here. And the fight with authoritarianism and censorship has never been between conservatives and progressives, both of which come out of a liberal tradition. It's always been with authoritarians. If you want to make a left-right spectrum where, I don't know, Ron DeSantis is on the far right and Bernie Sanders is on the far left, however you want to define that, I don't really like the idea of a left-right spectrum, but we'll use it for the moment. We want to make a Y spectrum. There are people that believe that you counter ideas with other ideas, and they can come from the conservative circle or from the progressive circle. And there are people that believe, I'm going to use my power to shut you up. And they can be 1950s Republicans that are McCarthyite scaremongers. They can be religious conservatives that are trying to ban any book involving Darwin or whatever. Or they can be Democrats that are trying to ban people or ban books or whatever. So to me, it's the censorious people are not rooted in the right or left. It's a temperament rather than a philosophy.
Like a hierarchical, authoritarian-centric power kind of position.
Exactly.
You need to control the flow of information or something.
I think the relevant spectrum is authoritarian to pluralist. Pluralist, which is, I am a hardcore pluralist. You don't find a lot of people that would identify as such, but I'm a hardcore capital P pluralist. A pluralist believes society is big enough to have disagreements within it. Like I'm here in Austin, Texas. I could literally, if my neighbor were a flat earther, I could deal with my neighbor. It wouldn't freak me out. It would be weird. I would actually be, frankly, very interesting. But like politically, I didn't vote for Trump. One of my best friends voted for Trump. It didn't affect our friendship. I have a hard time envisioning myself ever voting for Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, but I have dear friends that voted for him. As a pluralist, I can, like, it's just, you just have to be polite and get along with each other. And the ideas fight and the best idea rises to the top, right? Whereas authoritarians want to squash the evil ideas and squash the people that promote them. And that can come from anywhere.
Who would you give examples of on both sides, quickly? Of a authoritarian. I would guess Ron DeSantis seems to be trying to get rid of a lot of stuff in Florida.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, my take of DeSantis is I think that he's more opportunistic, and I think that he's learned a lot of lessons from Donald Trump. So a lot of which appears to be censorship, I think, is really just him trying to get earned media attention from media. So the best example, which we talked about on the show here about a year and a half ago.
The actions are censorship.
Well, sort of like the don't say gay laws, for example. It's my understanding that in Florida, what was passed was you were not allowed to instruct kindergartners in issues of sexuality. The law did not say mention it, because we got, by the way, I got a lot of feedback on that episode where people went, you know, I am gay. I am worried that this would mean that if I mentioned my husband in the classroom that I would be fired. While that is always a legitimate concern with authoritarians, I think that the law, the way it was written, was you can't instruct, not mention, but instruct. And it boiled down to, look, you can't teach sex ed to kindergartners. That was the long and the short of it, which the vast majority of Americans agree with. And it immediately got picked up because it was Ron DeSantis and he's a Republican from Florida and got turned into an anti-LGBTQ thing. And I think he planned it that way. I think he knew that if he wrote a law that his base would broadly agree with and see as stark raving sane, and it got punted up to the media sphere. So I think that happens to Mount. But sure, conservatives who are Turner trying to like in certain states, I want to say they'll occasionally have a thing where they'll literally try to ban evolution in schools. And that happens.
Well, the other thing is the what's the race, critical race theory?
Critical race theory.
Which is literally just teaching about a lot of teaching about black history. People are like, absolutely not right. In our state. You're not allowed to do that. That's getting rid of an idea.
Right. Sure, and
stopping ideas.
As a pluralist, my thing is combat that with other ideas. Like you could say some people think X, some people think Y. I don't know. I think if you go back in history, I would say McCarthy would be the best example of a conservative authoritarian censorship figure. Or if you want to get like, I guess centrist would be J. Edgar Hoover. Because he was just going after people and ideas, and I have no idea what party he was. And then you got cancel culture today, yeah.
I did not expect to hear about Hoover today, but
let's get back to Gatsby. Andrew, either one of you guys want to go on this, Andrew?
Yeah. So I think I don't know how much we need to dwell on it, but do we want to talk about Gatsby as a comedian versus storyteller versus, you know, how what do you think of her relative to someone like Mike Birbiglia? You know, and doing comedy, you know, Turner, you and I have had conversations about this at length. Heaton, we probably have too, but I'm remembering a particular one with Turner where, Turner, you said something, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not going to have the right amount of nuance here, where you were like, comedy means making people laugh. And whatever you want to do to make that happen counts as comedy. And if you're not laughing, then my God, maybe you're not doing comedy. And so I would put Hannah somewhere in the middle. She's obviously not just out there getting laughs, but I have laughed at things that Hannah Gatsby has said. And sort of just the idea of using comedy to do other things. And Heaton, you and I have talked about this as far as politics goes. You know, introducing humor into things can help us get past, and maybe to use your pluralism language, can help us, you know, be more open to ideas through comedy as a tool to do that. So I am impressed by Hannah for that reason, more than about any particular message that she's given or to say that she's particularly funny. And I'm curious, you know, where you all land on this. Do you have other people you do like who maybe travel that path of combining comedy with other things, or is it just not your cup of tea?
It's not my cup of tea.
Okay.
I'll preface all of this. I have not seen Nanette. I have never seen Hannah Gadsby. It could very well be that I would watch her and find her hilarious and brilliant, and that I would come away from that and go, this is awesome. So
if you stay with us, I'm going to make you watch it with me.
Can I
anti-cancel culture
on that?
Yeah.
we'll take bets on how I react to it. When I stay with you, we'll watch that after the cocktail party. It'll be a really interesting evening. But let me talk about that rather than just focusing on Hannah, I'm going to use her as a touchstone for this concept in general. One, I don't like the trend we've had in culture of dramedies. I think they're just lazy comedies. And I see this across. So like The Good Place, great, great drama that's occasionally funny. It's not a comedy. It's a shit comedy. If you watch
it's not funny. Yeah.
It is a laugh every minute and a half. That's horrible by sitcom standards. Sitcoms have I did the math on this one time. I was writing, I think I've told you guys before that I got roped into writing a sitcom spec script for the Weather Channel.
And, that's amazing.
It went just as well as you think it did.
Can we do a table reading and record it as a bonus episode?
Oh my God. I would love to do that. Yes. Should. I will. I will.
Was there a character named El Nino?
Transgender and is El Nina or something?
While I was researching that and I was learning how to write a sitcom pilot, and there's definitely a really firm structure to it. Sitcoms are the most formulaic form of comedy. 30 Rock had a joke every average of 17 seconds. Whereas Two and a Half Men had an average of every 25 seconds. But sitcoms have to have it all the time, right? I look at something like The Good Place, which was interesting, good drama, et cetera. If we want to call it a drama, it was great. It was great.
I didn't know it was considered a comedy, is it?
That was how it was initially billed, and it's why I didn't like it the first year it came out. Because my friends would tell me about this new comedy, and Ted Danson's in it, who's a national treasure. And I would watch it and go, this isn't funny. I'm not watching this. I went back and I watched it as a drama that is occasionally funny, and it was fine. So maybe it's just that I'm raggedly linguistically puritanical about this. This could be the problem, that if Hannah Gadsby just goes, yeah, I'm not a comedian, I'm a funny speech person, I'd be like, oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Okay. 100. Interesting.
I mean, you can make an argument that I'm a very funny pundit. I get it. But I find that or I'm going to piss off some other people here too. There's a show called Lower Decks. It's a Star Trek cartoon, and it's billed as this hilarious, hilarious cartoon. It's a pretty good Star Trek episode that's occasionally funny. It's it's not anywhere on par with Futurama or Rick and Morty. It's just not that funny compared to them, right? And then this is my inner bitter comedian comes out. I've worked on a spec script, as I talked about. I've worked on a script. I've written short stories and I've written novels. All of these can be brilliant in their own way. People that write short stories can be brilliant. Essayists can be brilliant, et cetera, and so forth. Writing novels is a lot harder than writing a short story, and both are harder than writing scripts. You can be the most brilliant script writer. You could be more brilliant than a novelist. I'm not saying otherwise, but writing a novel is just, it's more difficult. You have to be dealing with more things over more time. I see in comedy a lot of people going no, I just don't want to write jokes. Because that's the hardest part. The hardest part of doing stand-up is writing the jokes. You have to sit down and write jokes. It's tough. Because stand-up comedy is the highest distillate form of comedy. All you're doing is telling – you're just doing set up punchline again and again and again.
It's the contortion of jokes, because contortion is just circus with your body and no apparatus. But go on. Mm-hmm.
There you go.
And so I'm not a huge fan of all of that. I think somebody that does a great job of merging comedy with having – some kind of philosophical input is Eliza Schlesinger. I think Eliza Schlesinger is very talented, very, very funny, and she will do a really solid, funny stand-up special, and every once in a while she will go, but really, you should never feel bad because of X or whatever. So every few minutes she's earned that moment where she'll slip in something and she'll be like, I'm going to be vulnerable and serious with you for a moment. But doing half joke, half speech, which, by the way, totally get, because I get booked to do think tanks on a regular basis, and they always go, do you want to do a speech or do you want to do comedy? And I go, oh, a speech, of course. Like tell everybody I'm doing a speech, because there's lower expectations, and I get to bring my notes up to the podium.
And your jokes kill.
And my jokes kill. I'm going to end up doing my stand-up anyway, but also I have a lot more leeway, because if I'm giving a speech, I can do my stand-up, and then if there's just something I want to talk about for 5 minutes, I can, and it's a really funny speech. But if I do that with stand-up, it's real shit stand-up. So I get it, but I don't like it when comedians, in my view, kind of slow down and go that route.
I to put it into contortion terms,
please. Right,
you said contortion's the hardest thing to do.
Well, no, it's true? The purest form of circus. You could argue, but based on Heaton's analogy, that stand-up is the most distilled version of comedy, because you don't have a scene or other.
What's
actors.
The hardest thing? What's the hardest thing to accomplish in circus?
I mean, if we go, I think contortion could be just because you don't have other apparatuses. The hardest thing, as far as I know, actually does require an apparatus in contortion, is a mouth stand, where you stand and you bite down on a little kind of a piece of wire, and then you balance on your head with your legs over the front of you. And so your whole body weight is on your teeth and you're upside down.
Great.
That.
So to put it into those terms, what Hannah Gadsby did.
Wait, are you going to circus blade to Andrea?
I'm so ready. I'm here for it. I love it.
I'm ready to do it.
Let's go.
I'm ready
to
do it.
This is
she did. Well, that's why I wanted your information first. I don't know what I'm talking about. So
yeah, that's
good. She said, I'm not going to do the mouth thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm better than that and I've moved past that. So instead, I'm going to be like, you know, those people who just wave flags like in the middle of a marching band?
Right.
I'm going to wave the flags because I don't have time to waste my time and my career with this lowly form of art where you put something in your mouth and you flip upside down. It doesn't express my interest as much.
But it has enough time for puns.
Is standing around waving a flag. And that's what I don't think any. I can't speak for everybody. I'm sure there were people who threatened because she was a they or they was a they and is that threatens people's lives. I'm sure that I'm sure
she
there are those people.
She actually is
a
she, not a they. I don't know if that's
if in the New York Times it says they.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Maybe that's recent?
Maybe.
Okay. As far as I'm trying to be specific. I genuinely
No, I don't know. Yeah.
I could be, unless I read it incorrectly.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was the other art culture magazine that called that.
Okay.
But okay, let's go with she for this
topic.
And then if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, it's your fault.
Okay, great. So, yeah. I am going to get canceled first. I think we can all agree.
Okay, we can all agree with that. So I think what most comedians wanted to say, but at the time in 2017, you literally couldn't say this. People who were saying this were getting attacked as a misogynist, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it was that someone who's not as good as the higher level people in comedy, not as good at comedy as the higher level people in comedy, is saying, I'm not doing that anymore because I'm better than that. And instead, I'm doing this other thing that we all thought was easier. So it seemed like a very convenient cop-out is the way I think. I think I speak for most people in comedy. I've had a zillion of these conversations when everyone knows the phones are turned off and nobody's listening and the door to the green room is closed and it's just comics sitting in a room. And we all say that. The issue of us is that none of us were brave enough or articulate enough to say that in a place like the New York Times. And it took her launching herself into the art world for art experts to be like, whoa, slow down.
Yeah.
You don't know anything about art. And they said that was a big story in comedy because they were saying all the things that we wanted to say, but were too stupid to put into words, even though we had it all in our heads. And so I think the issue is not, is there this world for someone who's doing half comedy, half storytelling like Mike Birbiglia? It's
like David Sedaris is a very funny storyteller.
I think most people, everyone loves David Sedaris and respected. Yeah. I think there is,
Garrison
but
Keillor.
You also can't just shit on comedy.
Garrison Keillor's been canceled.
Yeah.
Did you know that? Yeah. Okay.
He got canceled. But I think there is not room for someone to say, well, comedy's beneath me. I'm better than that. So I'm going to cry. You know,
right.
Like, well, we could all cry.
I think that and maybe I need to rewatch it, but I think that I don't think that's what she was saying in terms of I'm better than comedy.
Then we all interpreted it incorrectly.
Yeah.
I can't wait till this cocktail party / movie party that we're going to have. This is going to be great.
This is going to be rough. Yeah. But I do see why that would make, your analogy makes sense, Turner, in the context of like, oh, I'm not going to do this anymore. So here's like a worse version of it. And I'm going to justify it because I'm better than it.
Because I'm better than it.
Right. Right. But I don't think she said that.
If you're in that world.
Yeah.
Okay. So if she didn't say that, then it was interpreted incorrectly.
Yeah. I think it was interpreted. I could be wrong. I read it as it's bad for me because I'm telling self-deprecating jokes and I have lived a life soaked in shame. And so, but that's.
Well, to that
say,
point.
Wait, just one piece there is that the way I read that is she said, comedy is too limiting for me because comedy is about self-deprecation and I'm not going to do that anymore because I'm becoming more me, right?
Well, and she was saying her own jokes were about self-deprecation and it was
reflecting.
I didn't
see that part.
Okay.
I saw it as comedy is that. So maybe I read it incorrectly, but that's how I saw it. And that's how a lot of people I talked to saw it.
Okay.
And so is it, we all kind of went, well, no, it doesn't have to be. There's many ways to do comedy.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, and one of the reasons I thought her, and maybe this is just, you know, we maybe hear what we want to hear. And I heard, you know, that she was saying, I'm doing all this self-deprecating comedy because I feel bad about myself because I grew up in a very conservative place that told me that being gay is a sin. And so I'm reflecting that in my own self-deprecating comedy, and I need to move on past that. And I have been thinking about how I do nothing but self-deprecating comedy. And at that, until that moment, had never questioned why I do that. Why is that the funny thing? Why am I the butt of the joke? And I still do self-deprecate. It's literally all I have. But I thought she was making a good philosophical point, and I didn't read it as saying I'm better than comedy, but it's definitely, I can see where that interpretation would come from. And maybe that is what she said. I can't say.
And then, sorry, I know I said one last thing before, but I got one more.
Go for it.
She also had said very publicly that that was going to be the end of her comedy career because it was over for her. She was moved beyond. I thought she had said she moved beyond it. Maybe she said she just can't do it anymore. Anyway, it was over. But then she made a ton of money off of it, so then all of a sudden it wasn't over.
That I don't know. Yeah.
There's a New Yorker article here from 2018, where literally the opening line says, Nanette, the Australian comedian Hannah Gadsby's latest stand-up show, which runs at Soho Playhouse through May 26, is her last.
All right.
That's the opening line.
Then she's full of shit and she's making money. I'll grant you that. I won't defend that.
So that's the other thing that I can tell you gets talked about in green rooms all over the place when her name comes up. They're like, I thought she quit 5 years ago.
Right.
Anyway, sorry.
Andrea, again, while I've not seen it, I do very much relate to you on the self-depreciation thing. I think that that is a major, major occupational hazard of stand-up comedy because in my experience, audiences don't like you can shoot the moon and be better than the audience. Paul F. Tompkins does that. He comes out in a three-piece suit. He puts on this air of a sophisticant who's talking down to the audience. Judah Friedlander does that in an absolutely hilarious way because he's like 40 pounds overweight and just looks ridiculous. But he's great. I love Judah Friedlander. But he comes out and acts like he's better than the audience. So you can do it if you have got like a swagger. But 95% of the comedians there, we're operating as a cathartic gesture for the audience. The audience has had a tough week. They want to come out and laugh at somebody who's flailing even harder than they are. And I learned this early on back in D.C., where I was coming from Congress. One day I had a suit on. I walked up to the microphone, and before I said anything, I heard a guy in the back go, "Oh, fuck this guy!" And I haven't said anything, but I get it though, because he didn't want to see some well put together dude come up and make funny jokes. And like my stand-up got much, I started like really leaning into my Oklahoma accent because it made me sound more baffled. But I noticed from an occupational hazard standpoint that I was peppering my personal life with self-depreciation far more than I should. Mm-hmm. Like, it's funny if I go up on stage and I say, I look like a pregnant spider. I'm so skinny and spindling, but I'm getting a bit of a gut. It's like a meerkat where if you draped a blazer over a hat rack, I can get lines, laughs for that. That doesn't work well on dates. Going on a date and explaining why you should definitely not have sex with me in an amusing way is not a great way to go on a date. And it's one of those things where I think like comedians have to be on guard to make sure that we're not letting the darkness in by doing the things that get us trained SEAL laughter.
So Turner, I want to know what you think about this because I have experienced that different comedy scenes have different appetites for this. So I felt that, and Turner, you and I have talked about this at length and you know the scene much better. I always felt that in Shanghai, which is where I started and you were, you know, built the scene, that self-deprecation didn't really work there. And that audience was often be like, what, why are you so sad? And then I came to New York and my first ever open mic, I said, I'm a professor, I live in China. And everyone was like, fuck you. Like kind of, you know, open mics are a different scene. But I feel like in New York, you expect self-deprecation and you can't be that successful. Whereas in China, you could. And I mean, I'm not saying that it had anything to do with Chinese or American culture. I think it's the scene and the audiences and what people expect. On the other hand, I did a show at the Grizzly Pear Midtown over the weekend. I was the last comic on the show and I came up and said, I quit my job. I'm a deadbeat. And someone in the audience was like, ugh. And I was like, oh, they don't want to hear another failure because I was probably the eighth comic they'd seen that night who was listing why they were a failure. And so I turned it around and did some other more like normal functioning stuff. And it actually did much better. Maybe that's a fluke of the room. Maybe they just needed someone higher energy. I don't know. But it's I think the self-deprecation really varies. And I think we're in a culture brought in probably by Louis C.K. that has been like, self-deprecation is sort of what you expect. And that's a trend. You know, Seinfeld doesn't self-deprecate. He didn't self-deprecate at the height of his influence.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's a good point. The Louis C.K. thing is a really great point because he, obviously a very high level, talented stand-up comedian, figured out how to kind of take his life, which on the surface was a very bland life, just a schlubby looking dad, bald, fat dad of two little kids and a wife.
Yep.
And turn that into being able to relate to like every dad and therefore and parents in America of everything they're thinking but don't say.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why he hits so hard is because all across, you could be in Dallas, Texas, you could be in Omaha, you could be in New York City, people have that feeling, yep. Right? So he was really tapping into that. I think, and which is a very clean, normal thing, I think what a lot of newer comedians took out of that is, well, he did have one joke about how he masturbates when his wife's not around.
He calls himself a piece of shit.
About, I'm going to do 10 minutes about jokes about how I masturbate and I'm a piece of shit by not even noticing, skipping over the real art that was in it, which was giving parents the license to... It's okay to sometimes not like your kids.
If you're going
to
tell a masturbation joke at this point, it better be pretty goddamn funny. I have one masturbation joke in my entire set, and it does okay. But like, I've heard more masturbation jokes than the Geneva Convention allows by law at this point in my life. And particularly...
Louis. Do you remember Louis about 9/11?
Oh, God. No.
It was, you can tell how bad of a person you are by how early you started, you masturbated again after 9/11.
That's pretty funny.
He goes, for me, it was after the first plane hit, but before the second one.
That's so bad.
But anyway, so I think that there is, and being self-deprecating doesn't have to be like, I'm fat, I'm a loser, I'm skinny, I'm a loser, I'm short, I'm a loser. It doesn't have to end with, I'm a loser.
Right.
It can be... my spouse and I went out and did this, and this was, there's a way to, you can get yourself in awkward situations.
Right.
Seinfeld was constantly in awkward situations. Larry David is always in awkward situations, but we never think he's calling himself a loser.
Yeah.
Oftentimes he's almost letting you call him a loser while he's tongue in cheek saying he's correct.
Right.
There's whatever this definitely is. Different expressions of this. And by the way, Turner, you are the finest mind in terms of framing these things and looking at comedic spectrums that I've ever met. One of the things that you brought up to me that's been deeply impactful to me in the comedy that I do is you brought up that comedians tend to either be the sane person in a mad world, like Seinfeld, who is going like, can you all not see this thing?
What's
isn't this
on?
Nuts? Or I am the crazy person in a sane world, like Mitch Hedberg.
Yeah.
I'm the nutball, right? And that like a lot of the time, if Andrew Heaton play the sane character. I'm not coming in being a crazy person. Like I will occasionally like in sketches and maybe in a monologue or something. But when I'm doing stand up, I'm making observational comedy much more in the vein of Seinfeld. So if I suddenly do like a crazy joke, it's running against my character and people can't articulate why that joke may not land. And then the other bit, Turner, that I'm going to steal from you, and feel free to correct me or elaborate on all of this, but I take Turner notes internally. we were hanging out in a hot tub in Tulsa. After we'd done an open mic or something, I don't know. We got paid, but the gig got canceled or something.
Oh yeah.
You brought up that there are differences in crowds between people that like smart humor and smarter than humor. And you maybe phrased it differently, but you brought up one of your jokes, Turner, is you go, have you ever done anything that made you realize you're even stupider than you already thought? And that joke will do very well in Kansas. That joke does not do super well in the hip parts of Brooklyn. Because in the hip parts of Brooklyn, a lot of the identity is, well, I'm smarter than most people. Like my identity, it's not that I'm a smart person, it's I'm smarter than other people. And that kind of humor tends to be much more referential because if I reference obscure things and you know them, you can laugh and feel better. Whereas like when you're doing comedy in China, like you regularly will go like, I was over at Pizza Hut. You guys know Pizza Hut? It's a fast food chain for pizza. Cause you're just trying to, you're just trying to establish the data point and move on to the joke. The joke's not the reference, but if the joke is the reference, it's much more likely to be that smarter than kind of humor.
Yeah, which is like a joke that ends in, what is this, Deep Space Nine?
Yes, exactly.
And everyone laughs if they know Deep Space Nine.
I did.
But if they, I didn't even say the
That's
joke.
That's just such a perfect punchline for just any shitty joke.
That, yeah,
that's my new go-to.
I'm just going to try that. The next time something's off the rails, I'm just going to end with that and like see what happens. That's amazing.
What is this? Do you say that? But yeah, and then the third one, which I would say Louis does, is, and I do as well, is the insane person in an insane world. So you're confront, just like Seinfeld confronts an insane scenario, but he's going, these people are crazy. What Louis's doing is going, what they're doing is crazy, and my reaction to them is going to be even more crazy.
Right.
Fascinating.
Right.
So 9/11's nuts that happened. Ah. And my reaction was to just jerk off.
I've got a thinky question for you both. Okay. 2 years ago, I interviewed a very smart lady, a guest I really enjoyed, named Danigal Goldthwait Young. She wrote a book on political. Do you know Dana?
Not She's personally, great. But we're in similar circles for reasons
I could totally see that. She's cool. I really liked her. She's got another book coming out. Hopefully she'll come back on the show. So she wrote a book on political satire. The thesis to her book was that conservative media went into outrage radio and liberal media went into political satire. I don't agree with everything in it, but there were some interesting ideas that she parsed out. I'll note, according to Dana Goldthwait Young, she's only talking about conservatives and liberals in terms of social context. She's not talking about how you feel about taxes or foreign policy or jurisprudence or anything like that. She's only talking about, are you a it would have been, in my opinion, better for her to say cosmopolitans and traditionalists, because that's what she was getting at. But in her language, she said that conservatives tended to have more of a problem with ambiguity than liberals did. And that liberals were okay having more amorphous things. So she gave an example in her book that liberals would have art that did not have frames in it, and it might be abstract art, whereas conservatives were more likely to have framed art. They liked having things clearly delineated, and the art that they had was very realistic, that it was more likely to be a landscape or a portrait. It was something that you could understand very quickly.
So the conservatives didn't like Picasso either? Is that what I'm hearing?
The conservatives what?
The conservatives didn't like Picasso either.
Yeah,
he's so
abstract. Nobody liked it. Well, no, the only reason that I bring this up, and by her definition, I don't think any of us would qualify as like super traditionalists or anything. But I would say that in this conversation, Turner and I have been far more concerned with clearly delineating what is and isn't. Whereas Andrea, who by their own admission is much further left on the spectrum, seems to be much more okay with ambiguity. So I wonder if that's not kind of doubling down on Dana's point.
It could be. Yeah. I mean, I think that comedy should be funny.
Turner, get your head out of the ground. No.
I feel like I'm stuck in the old days, though. I'm also like, I think a man should have a penis. Like, it's like the same. Yeah, is that the same argument? I don't really know. But I didn't think I was saying anything.
Yeah, Nanette is a they
controversial.
Of comedy albums. Yeah. No, I'm with you.
Because I've had a lot of people. I tell people, which I've thought since I was 13 years old, that the best comedian of all time is Norm Macdonald.
I agree.
And people will often say, well, I mean, he's the funniest, but
right.
And I'm like,
what's the other?
That he wins.
Yeah,
that he's the best.
We were talking about comedy.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I think you're right in the sense that. Let me back up. So as we've been having this conversation, I have kind of reflected in my own mind that I would be 100% fine if, looking back, we decide that Hannah Gatsby's Nanette is classified as performance art. Fine. I don't think it needs to be called a comedy. I don't think I'll die on that hill. I don't think you're saying anything out of control, Turner, by saying that comedy should be funny. I'm interested, Heaton, to go back to your point about television shows, is that I actually probably don't really watch many comedies. Like, I'm watching Succession, haven't finished it, don't spoil it. And I love the fact that there's probably two moments in each miserable hour that are super funny, and it only makes sense in the context of having watched four seasons of these wretched people. And so I like... I wouldn't call it a comedy, although HBO thought it was a comedy. I met someone who worked on that show, and they're like, oh, have you seen the new comedy Succession? You're like, no.
Will Ferrell's
an executive
producer. So
I'll be the first to say, fine, let's say Hannah Gatsby's isn't a comedy. I don't care. I am curious separately what we all think of, like, and Heaton in particular, because you go to Fringe all the time, like, one-person shows that are sort of funny. Turner, there are a lot of comics right now doing one-person shows at Soho Playhouse, and like they're semi-funny, semi-not. Like, I'm interested in where that lands in all of this. But we can call Hannah Gadsby performance art. That's fine. But I will say that the reason, one of the reasons it was so powerful for me when I first saw it was because I went to it expecting comedy. And then I was so surprised that it got so dark. And I felt like her ability to manipulate my own feeling in the show was so stunning. And I don't think I would have had that experience had I gone in expecting to be moved. And I just feel very lucky that I had that, because I think by the time most people saw it on Netflix, they were told it was supposed to be this big philosophical thing, you know. Whereas I was just like, this is going to be just like an hour at the Grizzly Pier. I don't know what this
by
is.
The way,
and I was
so
surprised.
We should also say that we don't all have to agree.
Yeah.
We don't like art. I think they said it best in Wayne's World, which
there
is that like not everyone has to be like everything. Like the line from Wayne's World, which is one of my favorite quotes of all time, is Wayne goes, "Hey man, like not everyone has to like you. Not even the Beatles didn't write songs that everybody liked. They left that to the Bee Gees."
that's awesome. Yeah,
you're not supposed to be liked by everybody.
No, no, no.
That's supposed to be.
My friend Jennings and I had a conversation as I was driving out to New Mexico where he was like, "You like Wes Anderson films, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, I love The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and I love Budapest, Grand Budapest Hotel. Yeah, they're some of my favorite films." And he's like, "Yeah, I hate them. I think you should try to fix me." And we were having this conversation where he's like, "A ton of people disagree with me on this. Clearly I'm missing something." And I was taking the position, "I think you should stay at Elitist, Jennings. I think you should."
Yeah.
Because it's like jazz.
Like, I'm sure it's good and people love it. It makes me stressed out.
Or there are things that I can even look at and say, I can tell that's a good thing. It's just not for me. Right. So like Mad Men. I watched one episode of Mad Men, and I was like, this is clearly well-written, clearly well-executed, excellent costumery, good plot characters, actors. I'm just not super into it. But, like, I can objectively tell it's really good. I just – it's not good for me. Those things happen all the time.
Can I – I think this might be a good place to land this whole thing.
Sure.
And bringing it back to where we started. So I also think there was an issue which comes up from time to time in politics in America, in kind of everything, art – appreciation for art. You just said you don't like jazz music, right?
Mm.
Completely fine. Completely not allowed to like jazz music.
Thank you.
Yeah, and at any point in your life, you're allowed to not like jazz music. I do think there was a time in 2017-18 when you said, "I don't like Nanette, I don't like Hannah Gadsby," people think you're saying something bigger than just, "I don't think she's funny."
Have I ranted about Hamilton? Have I ranted to you guys about Hamilton?
No, but I'm not surprised that you have a Hamilton rant. I mean that in a flattering way. Yeah.
I'm just not a big fan of Resha Shativ. Like, I'm not a big fan of Resha Shativ, the thing where you're singing talking. That's just not for me.
I was like, who? Yeah.
you're singing talk. You're talking in a rhythmic manner as opposed to singing.
So
I like show
rap?
Tunes.
No, I'm kidding. We're not going to.
I don't like rap, and it might be great. It's just not for me, right?
Turner hates black people. He said it.
That right there. I have got shit for that before, where I said I don't like rap, and I said it partly because I don't particularly like the sound of it, but also it seems to be a lot of dick swinging, and I don't like that kind of bravado. And a person that was just as white as me went, you know, if you'd grown up like out of privilege, you would appreciate blah 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 blah. And I was like, I just heard a bunch of misogynist bullshit come out of the radio you listen to. I don't know why them being black suddenly extricates themselves from that problem that I would put anywhere else. But no, with Hamilton, I just don't care for Resha Shativ. Everybody else can love it. I think it's great that it's brought in people to American experience
and
brought over other folks. And that the one song I really like is "You'll Be Back," which is sung by King George III, which is played by a white
you
guy.
Are racist.
And so everybody's like, "Oh, you like the one song a white guy sings?" And I'm like, I didn't fucking know he was white when I heard it on an album. It's just that's the one song that's sung in the whole thing. But there was like a 3-year period where I couldn't say that because if I didn't love Hamilton, I was a racist that wanted King George III to own slaves or some shit.
All right, this is my point. But also, I mean, Hamilton's a whole nother. It's a very like Hillary Clinton left, as I call it. Like,
I've never even heard a single Hamilton song. I don't know anything about it.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
I know of it. I've heard of it, but yeah.
My main point is, why are we celebrating the guy who created the Fed? You know, that's such a such a Hillary Clinton a liberal thing to do. Like I always call him the Hillary left. Like the real like centrist left, like big but big government, big America. But anyway, so my point is, and to bring it all the way back to the beginning, is I'm sure there was a time when you would be a racist if you said I don't like jazz. I'm sure there was a time in the 60s where you had to like jazz. Heaton doesn't like Hamilton. I mean, from the other side, Charles Barkley, the fantastic former NBA player, now commentator, once said, I think Hamilton was up for Hip Hop Album of the Year. And he said, there's not a single person driving through the hood right now bumping Hamilton. And he was furious that why would that be Hip Hop Album of the Year?
If I ever hang out with Charles Barkley, we're going to have a fun chat. We're going to have a lot of
fun. He's invited to this cocktail party if we can somehow make that happen.
So I think what my bigger point is, this article feels like the death of that for this certain topic and maybe a bigger topic. You are now finally allowed to say, I don't like Hannah Gadsby. And it doesn't mean that you're outside throwing rocks at pride parades.
Right.
You know, it right. just means she's not funny to you.
Right. And anything else she had to say didn't land in any meaningful way. And that's fine, too.
Exactly.
Yeah. I hope that you're right, Turner, in the sense that here's my denouement on all this is that I'm hopeful that this means that like the moral outrage is waning, because it's very exhausting to say exactly as you said. And I actually, jazz has been so, I think, white-ified that I was like, oh, I don't like jazz because I'm not a sophisticated white person who likes jazz. But you're right. Mm. Black people invented jazz. I forgot.
Yeah, sure.
But I like to think that, yeah, we can have our tastes and they're not reflective of our broader views on whether or not people are gay or can be gay or whether that's okay. And I would like to see that change on both sides. I would like to go back to just having, maybe go forward, maybe we've never been there, to just being able to say ideas and talk about them and not have it mean, well, you must like slavery or whatever.
Well, and the one dying, I think we're in the dying gasps of this.
Yeah.
And the people who co-created the art exhibit with Hannah Gadsby retweeted, these two women retweeted the New York Times review and said, well, the New York Times, I'm paraphrasing, but it's something that the New York Times doesn't like us. Shocker, this article is written by a man.
Oof.
And so,
that's tiring.
Yeah, so they're still trying. Anyway, Heaton, final word, and then Let's we should go. Probably get out of here.
Well, hold on. We can cut this bit out. Do we want to do a poll on who's more likely to get canceled? Because I thought that'd be kind of fun.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, we can end on that.
So we were, listeners, we were joking with each other on our text chain on who is the most likely to get canceled. And I am going to put up a poll. I'll make it public. It'll be on patreon.com/AndrewHeaton, but I'll make it a public post so anybody can come and weigh in on this and see how it's going. We were debating who would get canceled. Andrea posited that they're most likely to get canceled because of the circles that they swim in that are, you know, NYU Manhattanites and so on and so forth. I agree. I think Andrea is the most likely to get canceled. I think I'm slightly more likely than Turner, only because I'm more political than Turner.
You can say famous.
No, I don't.
Don't be jealous, Turner.
Turner, you're a more successful comedian than I am, and you're definitely producing more comedy than I am. So there's more output. But I'm more likely to piss people off about like fucking tariffs or something. And I've had like the boat makers association come after me because of my position on the Jones Act. But all the same though, I think that, the people that are going to flip out about word choice are far more likely to be in Andrea's camp. And so I think Andrea, you live in a greater danger than I do. I'm not worried about my audience coming after me at all.
Yeah. I'm going to end up the way of Jordan Peterson any day now. Basically,
there's the only. So I do not think there's. I find it's like 0% chance I'll ever get canceled. My wife Ye is worried about that all the time. She's like, "What if these people? You say the wrong thing, and then people come after us, and then blah 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 blah." And I'm like, "Trust me. Like, number one, I genuinely don't give a shit." and so I think that alone deters people because they're like, "Well, he's not even going to be fun if we go after him." He's not going to care. So then it's not worth it unless the person's genuinely upset and hopefully apologizes and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And but number two, I mean, the amount of stuff Kaplan and I have said on the podcast over the years, just over and over and over again. And so far, nothing. I mean, it's
I gotta
really
switch audiences.
It's upsetting at this point. No, it's insulting. I mean, like, It's insulting that no one cares. Now, I am doing a show this weekend with, this is the only chance I have, Jocelyn Chia, a stand-up comedian in New York City, who's currently being canceled by Malaysia, the country of Malaysia.
Yes.
She's a good friend of mine. She's American, but grew up part of her time in Singapore, has U.S. citizenship. They're in Malaysia, they're currently protesting at the U.S. embassy that for trying to get the American government to arrest her for things she said. And the U.S. people, imagine these people who work at the U.S. embassy. They're like, we don't do that.
Who?
I don't know, I know how we work, but we don't arrest comedians. They're furious because in Malaysia, they can get comedians arrested. And I know people who've been arrested for things they've said on stage.
Wow.
And she made this joke about the Malaysian Airlines flight. And it went viral, and now they want her in prison. And anyway, I'm performing for her this weekend, with her this weekend in Long Island. And she just texted me something about she's doing a Fox News interview right before that.
That's so funny.
So I could be canceled by the end of this weekend by Malaysia, but who cares?
No, you have a chance. That's
can't
good.
Go to Malaysia anymore? Big deal. You know?
Here's the circles I'm treading in, all right? So I posted something maybe a year ago about how the word microaggressions is a word that I don't care for because it just means small behaviors that sometimes are harmful, but it's just a small behavior. And if anything, the word micro makes it sound like they're not consequential, even though they're small.
And just
I got
because,
so
can
much
I say
hate
this?
For that. Yes, go ahead.
Just because there are aggressions made by little people, we shouldn't use the term micro.
I got so much hate for that post because someone said that it was a microaggression of me to not cite the person who invented microaggressions. And I didn't even know that it was a term one person thought of. I thought it was just something that we all evolved
that,
eventually.
That and does sound and exhausting. That like
it sucks. I
get like the stuff that I deal with, which I don't mind, is I get like really esoteric fights people want to have.
Yeah.
Where like literally somebody sent me a letter a couple of days ago that was very nice, but explained why Lincoln was a horrible president because he suspended habeas corpus. Like people want to fight with me about Lincoln and stuff. And I'm like, this is the thing I got to do. Fine. We'll fight about Lincoln. I'm okay with this. So we're going to discuss, I'll get like emails that are like, you know, I've got a probing question on trade wars and we'll get into it, that kind of thing. But yeah, that, the word choice, that does sound exhausting, Andrea.
Yeah.
That,
and I just Googled it. Maybe we end on this. I just looked it up. The word microaggression was invented by one of the people in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
Perfect. All right, Turner, go get canceled. Let us know how it goes. We'll have another round table.
Fantastic. Great to see you all. Oh, wait. Yeah.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.